Recording in Los Gatos on April 18th, 2016. This is Geek Speak, episode 16 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geek's affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, your host and producer of Geek Speak. With me in the studio is Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a teacher, world traveler, programmer, and music geek. Hey, Ben.
Whoa, you're talking fast. Hi.
Hi. You got to talk faster.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Jaffe.
We should just mess up all podcast listeners by some of us speaking really slow.
Oh, yeah.
And that's Brian Young. He's an iOS developer, designer, and software conference producer.
You know, it's really cool to be here and talk to you guys.
You've been busy all over the place, haven't you?
I have been. I feel like I've had these virtual friends. I just keep listening to you. But you don't respond back to me when I talk to the radio.
No, it's so funny that way. It's an asynchronous medium. Hey, Brian, you just ran a tech conference up in Oregon.
I did. I got to talk to real live people. They actually looked at me as I talked.
Engineers, software engineers.
Software engineers,
you spoke on stage and made people happy and content with software.
Yeah. We explained all about features and cool products and cool stuff that we're doing.
And we have you for like 1 week and then you're off to Paris to do the show again.
Yeah. Got to keep it going.
Fancy world travel. And you're the one that says that you're a world traveler.
Yeah, I guess we should change that. We've talked about this before. Like,
you guys,
what do we call ourselves?
You can change your bylines anytime you want.
I guess I could.
Is it bylines?
Wait, if I change the byline, do you have to read it?
Yeah, I read whatever you say.
You have to.
Have to. It's okay. A rule.
I'll see what happens next week.
Hey, if you'd like to participate in the show, if you want to correct us or anything like that, please do feel free to email us, geeks@geekspeak.org. We read everything you write, even if we don't respond. Hey, did you really want to talk about synchronous and asynchronicity?
No.
Okay.
Well,
it was
you just started it. So
you had it there in the document, so I read it.
I wrote a question to you. So we have this doc that we read from, and I wrote something. Before we were talking about, what did you say? You said, because we have people who are listening and who help us with the show, and you said,
and they
can
listen
you
live.
listeners mute yourself? And I said, normally listeners of the podcast listen asynchronously,
yes,
because we record it and then they listen later.
Oh, and that's you what said, you meant. Yes.
Yeah, and you said, can you listen synchronously?
Yes.
And I said, yes.
Well, in as much as...
I think I'm right in this case, but I'm curious what you were thinking.
Well, let's see. Why don't we describe what synchronous and asynchronous is from a software perspective? Because that's what we're talking about.
That sounds good.
Go for it.
So, go for it. Okay. So let's take an example of something, of a language that's synchronous. So JavaScript, for example. When you're running JavaScript in the browser, I'm thinking single-threaded.
Yep.
Well, but JavaScript has synchronous and asynchronous capabilities.
Right. Okay.
So let's talk about that.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'll do the synchronous one. Mm-hmm. So you go and you tell the JavaScript engine to start counting from 1 to 1,000,000, and every time it counts a number, print it to the screen. While that operation is happening, there's no delay. It actually does write it to the screen on every cycle, if you will.
So it goes 0 and then writes it to the screen, and then 1 and then writes it to the screen.
Right. And what this means is that while it's writing to that screen, it's going to take a while to do that.
It takes a long time to write anything else.
And this is what you're talking about, single-threaded versus multi-threaded. But
right.
The point is that when you make the command, it does it. And
right.
There's no, please do this at some point, and something else does it. So now let's go to asynchronous.
Yeah, asynchronous would be count up to 1,000,000 and print along the way. And it would count as fast as it can, and that would probably take less than a second for a computer to do that. And it would print as it went, but since the printing takes a little while, it wouldn't actually print every single one. If you could almost imagine there are kind of two threads going on. One is the counting thread, and it's doing all the counting really fast, and the second one is the printing thread, and it prints the number, and then when it gets done, it tries to print the number again, and maybe it's up to 50 or 100 or something.
I was thinking that same situation, but at the very end, it would give you the final number, and then you would print that, meaning that it wouldn't actually like be doing anything you actually could see. It just later would come back with an answer.
Right.
So that's the asynchronous aspect.
And the dictionary definition definition of this.
Yeah.
Because synchronous is existing or occurring at the same time. Mm-hmm. And asynchronous would be not occurring at the same time. So that's that's the definition I was using.
For computer science perspective.
Yeah.
So now when we're speaking and I speak, you hear me at a later date. There's no way for you to block my speaking. There's no way for you to interact with it. You just hear it later. Now, granted, because later is very, very soon.
Because sound travels at a particular speed.
But at no point is there a communication where if you stop listening, I stop talking. So it's asynchronous in the sense that I don't know if you heard me or not.
Well,
it's
decoupled.
It's decoupled. But well, that's kind of...
I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it, in a computer sense?
If you had to say it was synchronous or asynchronous, I would call it asynchronous.
Okay.
But only because of the disconnect between our bodies. If we were the same body...
But I think that's what I was saying, is that listeners to the podcast listen asynchronously.
You said listen to the podcast. Yeah, right. But so were the people that are listening live are also asynchronous?
Well, I guess I implied something that was wrong.
All right.
Anyway,
I don't think you're ever wrong. So this is completely...
So this is a conversation that none of us were really prepared for that was based on something I wrote in a Google Doc. But we've got more interesting stuff.
Now, Brian, you have some initials here, and I don't even know what they stand for.
So Super NES.
Sneeze?
Super NES.
Oh. You're not a gamer?
Well, I don't know the S.
A gamer from the late 80s?
Yeah. I always called it NES. So Nintendo...
There was NES,
system.
And then there was SNES. Super. Sure. That was the next one.
I had the NES.
Yeah. Have you ever played a video game and there's been some sort of weird glitch? Like, I don't know, you just couldn't get out of a hole or
you jump through a wall somehow.
Yeah. The wall looks solid and you jump right through it.
Awesome.
So
Minecraft does it all the time because it can't paint all the volcanoes.
Oh, my goodness.
At the same time.
Minecraft, yeah. Filled with it. But we've talked about software bugs all the time before. And in fact, there's a lot of security glitches that come through software bugs and stuff.
Sure.
Well, the reason why those security glitches exist is because the computer is in a state that potentially you could take advantage of in a way that the programmer didn't initially intend. So I stumbled across this Twitter post. It's actually a YouTube video of somebody taking 7 minutes to sit down and describe how they turned a Super Mario Brothers Super NES game into Flappy Bird. Completely transformed an existing game on a cartridge into a completely different game.
On a cartridge?
I believe
so. We're not talking about decompiling and recompiling. We're talking about modifying a live game because of the bugs in it.
It's essentially taking a car that's running down the street while it's running and reorganizing the parts so that it's now an airplane.
An airplane, yeah.
Actually, so, I guess it's going from an airplane to a car.
So Mario Brothers is a very traditional game. It's called a platform game, and you're running from the left screen to the right screen.
Side-scrolling
platform. And of course, you leave the world by going down and up tubes or into doors, and then you load a new game system. And Mario, of course, the physics in that designed is that you are on the ground most of the time, and though you can jump and bounce on things, you keep falling. Gravity is persistent in that game.
Exactly.
And so what this person did is, because there's glitches in that game, you can actually do things that cause memory problems or runtime problems. When you do that, you theoretically could inject code into the running game.
Exactly.
So he's done this, describes how to do it, and makes what? Flappy Bird?
So Flappy Bird, a very big flash in the pan in the iOS community. There was a game called Flappy Bird came out. It's one of these games that for no apparent reason became very, very popular, especially since it's incredibly hard. It's an iPhone game.
Yeah.
Basically, you're a bird that has to fly through these columns. There's a top and a bottom column.
It's also a side-scroller, but it's a flying side-scroller, a platform side-scroller.
The funny thing about the game is, I mean, I think I played it for about 4 or 5 hours over the course of the weekend.
Oh my God,
popular.
Really?
And I only got about 5 or 6 columns in before I died. It's like an old-fashioned game.
It's a hard
game.
Yeah.
You don't keep going. You start over again.
And the person that made this game, which, by the way, this game is one of those things that any of us in the room could make over 6 months easily. Like, it's not a complex game.
Over a few weeks.
Well, software development always takes longer, so I know to multiply it by a lot.
Graphics, right.
Yeah.
Oh, you're like Scotty from Star Trek. Always multiply your estimates by a factor of 4.
Yes, perfect.
How else will they call you a miracle worker?
That's right. Nice quote. You got a Star Trek quote in. Nice.
Yeah, I did.
So Flappy Bird's relatively simple game, and what this person has done is injected real-time the ability to play Flappy Birds with Mario. Mario becomes
the Flappy. So Super Mario Brothers becomes the game Flappy Birds.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's you still have Mario. He's sitting there flapping.
Oh, so but he's slowly Mario falling. Is the bird.
Yeah, but you've got some of the artwork from Flappy Bird injected in there.
As well.
Huh? Yeah. Huh. So wait, how then? I mean, because the artwork for Flappy Birds is not in the original game.
No, no. You've got to, through essentially manipulating the glitches in the game, inject hex code.
He's also turned off gravity, or he's allowed Mario to jump when he's not on the ground.
So
like, there's a whole bunch of stuff
modified. He's modified the game, and he's injected other assets like graphics awesome. And whatnot into a running game by injecting hex codes in like a game that's on a cartridge.
Yeah, but he doesn't have like a text editor to sit and type out hex in. No, no, no. He's got to do things like go to sub-level, come back, grab P-switch, and then he has to get Yoshi from the right motion. Yoshi block. Do you even know what Yoshi is?
Yeah, Yoshi is the pwee-poo, that guy.
Nice. And then he has to glitch four berries in slot B, A, 7, and 6. But make sure that only one enemy is on the screen for berry slot 7. So no enemies are on screen for berry slot 6.
Wait, what does it mean to glitch a berry?
I'm not entirely sure.
This is like a whole...
It means, it's Ben, slang. That you have a real job. Because that would take so much time to figure out. That's insane.
Each one of these is just one of those little glitches that you see when you're playing.
So these are like exploits, basically, yes, in the game.
These are exploits. These
so are you saying that he's exploits. Actually injecting code by doing commands like that, by playing the game?
Well, once it gets into one of these states where you have some sort of buffer overflow or something, he's able to do something that puts hex or puts code onto the stack of the processor. In which case, another glitch is going to execute that instruction that he put on the stack previously.
That's beautiful.
So
reminds me of a bad science fiction movie. I'll get into this game no problem.
Okay, I've got two. First comment is, if you're one of those people who worked on Super Mario Brothers back in the day, this has got to be really trippy.
Yeah.
To see, like, not only did this game take off, but like people are completely obsessed with it and
it's a great game.
Modernizing it in a weird way.
Well, I wouldn't call this modernizing.
Well, I mean, it's still interacting with it and even building upon it.
Yeah, engaging with it a different way.
Yeah, in 2016. Like, that's ridiculous. The other question is, how do you spend 5 hours playing Flappy Birds? I don't, I really, really legitimately don't understand.
Brian, it was not consecutive. It was just a challenge. But over the course of a week, I put about 5 hours in this, and I never got more than about 6 or 7 columns.
So I got past one column on 3 runs of the game, and then I decided, this is stupid. Why am I doing this?
I beat the game.
You, what?
No.
No.
Yes,
no.
I did.
No. You can't beat the game, can you?
I beat the game, 100%.
You didn't play it at all.
I didn't play it.
I win. Wow.
I didn't even pay for it or anything. Didn't it cost money? It's like a buck or something?
Did it?
Or was there ads?
I think it was ad supported.
I didn't have an iPhone. I just waited for the Android clone.
And there was
one of the 700 of them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So I hear this fun afoot in the U.S. Congress.
Oh, yeah. And we talked about this a bit last week, but it's an anti-encryption law, as, of course, the government is
one.
A little bit obsessed with that. Yeah.
And you made a correction. You told me earlier it wasn't actually a law or a bill even.
It was
just
a proposal
to a bill.
Yeah, it's a proposed bill. And that's by Senators Richard Burr and Dianne Feinstein, who apparently don't know what they're talking about in terms of security. So... the fun thing about this story, I mean, we already covered this a little bit before, but the fun thing about this story is the things that people who are relatively well-known in the tech community have been saying about it. So Bruce Schneier, you guys know Bruce Schneier?
He's like a security expert, kind of.
World-renowned security expert.
Mm-hmm. People tend to know him. Many times.
Yeah. He noted a couple things publicly. One,
after reading the proposal of this bill?
Yeah, reading.
Okay, cool. I'd love to hear his analysis.
Basically, he said, so first of all, he said that the bill would basically make most of what the NSA does illegal unless the NSA is willing to backdoor its own encrypted communications.
That's fascinating.
So
the NSA,
it
of
applies
course,
to them too.
The NSA, of course, uses encryption to secure all its private data.
Right.
One of the jobs.
And then they want to break encryption to get everyone else's private data.
So they'd have to put a back door in for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In order to follow the law. I'm sure there's some override that they could, you know.
Sure, sure. Okay, that sounds kind of funny.
Yeah, so that's one. Another was lossy compression algorithms.
Like in compressing video?
Compressing video, audio? Compressing audio, compressing images.
Like the MP3 that people listen to right now.
Yeah, that is lossy compressed audio. And what lossy means is if you take the original file that is on that little box over next to you, Lyle, that's the
WAV file,
uncompressed data that is representing this podcast, and you edit it and everything and create a lossless file, and then you compress it. And that's to make it much smaller so you can send it out to everybody and they don't have to download 100 megabytes or something.
I don't think of that as encryption.
Right, but you can't go backwards.
Okay.
So if you have encrypted, if you have data and you compress it, you're effectively creating encryption.
Oh, because it's encrypted. Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Okay, so I totally respect Bruce Schneier, but... Mm-hmm. Develop the logic here, because this doesn't fit my definition of making it unintelligible.
What do you mean unintelligible?
The way I understand what the proposed law is that they're saying that you have to, any company producing software has to be able to take something that provide to the government on request intelligible form of that information. So obviously taking a photograph or a video and encoding it in JPEG or one of the codecs, I still see what the image is, so that's intelligible, isn't it?
Well, that's assuming that the image is the actual data that you're looking for.
So what Ben's saying is the original data is the actual raw source file. You change that data, it no longer...
So basically there is an argument.
That's a good point, though.
Yeah. There is an argument to be made that lossy compression algorithms would then become illegal. Now, there's probably also an argument to be made that they wouldn't. That would probably be fought out in court or something. But the point is that this is very poorly written legislation.
We're going to debate that.
Yeah, it's not precisely talking about what it's talking about.
Can you talk about the last side effect? Because this one's
the last side effect is even deleted data could be covered. And he's not saying this is necessarily the case, but he's saying, like, you could make an argument that when you delete data, you are producing something which has lost, data.
Well, here's an example. If I make an application that erases files on your computer really, really well, mm-hmm. one of the things you'd actually do is you'd find the sector on the disk that actually had the data originally, and you'd write random noise on top of it, right? Mm-hmm. You change those bits. So my software actually makes that data unreadable. Mm-hmm. Theoretically, I could, instead of doing a white noise on top of it, I could do a noisy but known pattern on top of it mm-hmm. that you could then retrieve the data from. So because my implementation doesn't allow me to retrieve the data again, I would be potentially breaking that federal law.
Right.
Because
right.
I was deleting files.
There's also, go ahead.
Well, I just love the idea that I can just imagine a headline in 2020 when this bill comes out. You know, accidentally the U.S. government forbids anybody from deleting files, and slowly the internet fills up and the world ends. You know, some kind of ridiculous story.
That was the year.
It all happened.
There is one more tweet that I want to share.
Sure.
By Joseph Lorenzo Hall on Twitter. He says, "Saying that math can't frustrate court orders is like saying a truck can't frustrate purple. These are different things." In other words, even though it feels like it makes sense if you don't necessarily know a lot about court orders or a lot about math or a lot about encryption, it's just unintelligible. It doesn't make sense. And that's one of the reasons that this legislation is so bad. Regardless of where you stand on backdoors and all that stuff, I mean, you know, we make our opinions fairly clear on the air and talk about why. But regardless of where you stand on that, it's just confusing legislation and it's not well defined.
You're listening to Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio KSP. I'm Lyle Troxel. With me is Ben Jaffe and Mr. Brian Young. In a second, we're going to talk about a whole bunch of fun things, including what a bike might look like if someone else drew and then someone created from those drawings. Also, should we feed the trolls? And of course, some stories from Apple. Stay with us, won't you? If you'd like to communicate with us, one way to do that is to visit us at Twitter or Facebook. We're KOSP Geeks, all one word. And if you have questions, of course, you can email us as well. We're geeks@geekspeak.org. I'm Lyle Troxel. This is Geekspeak here on KOSP. I'm talking with Ben Jaffe and Mr. Brian Young. Brian, you found some crazy engineering tacks.
So this was a fun experiment, a fun design problem. There was a gentleman who decided he was going to go out and depending on how you look at this, test somebody's memory. So he would stop people and ask them, would you please sketch for me what a normal men's bicycle looks like? You know, you can imagine.
It's got wheels. It's got handlebars.
It's got two wheels. It's got handlebars. It has a seat, and there's some sort of crossbar.
But he didn't say any of that. He said, can you please draw me a bicycle?
Right. This is something everybody has everyday knowledge of. Everybody's seen one. Everybody knows it intimately, which is why it is hilarious to take a look at some of the drawings that he gets out of these. So they all normally have all these elements that we're talking about, but the variety of different design elements that you get out of this is just it's just surprising. And this is terrible radio, but just imagine.
So there's a whole bunch of pictures of bicycles, and you can totally recognize that they intended to be a bicycle that would work.
Who drew these again?
Just random people.
Just random people? Like
random
on
people
the
that were stopped, yeah.
Wow, okay.
Not engineers.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Maybe one or two.
So just imagine, you normally can think of a triangle as a part of a bicycle, but where does that triangle go? How does that fit into the two wheels, or how the two wheels fit onto it? And when you start thinking about it, you realize that, well, maybe you could put the one corner of the triangle down to one of the wheels. Oh, wait. No, the triangle fits between the wheels, and the wheels don't actually touch the triangle. What he did was he took these designs that were just sketched out on paper that some of them make absolutely no sense, and he decided what it would be like to really build this. If you gave this design to some manufacturer, what would they have to do to put this together?
Ooh.
And all of a sudden, you have wheels that can't turn, or I'm sorry, steering that can't turn.
Steering
columns.
Because
everything is fixed and welded into the entire frame.
No forks, basically.
No forks.
Right? Yeah.
You've got different size wheels, which I don't know how people misremember that. You've got chains that actually go between the front
I think what's
wheel,
fascinating here,
the pedals, and the back wheel.
Whoa.
Front wheel, pedals, and the back wheel. Nice.
How would turning
very
work?
Very hard turning. Brian, I love that this is a radio story because, of course, our listeners who are represented here by these drawings, because if this is just a random sampling of people, I would love to hear if people actually right now can draw a bicycle without looking at it.
Yeah.
And if they come up with the same kinds of drawings.
Yeah.
Because to me, right away, I think about drawing a bicycle, no problem. I can draw a bicycle and it will be functional.
So I didn't do as well as you.
Oh, really?
I didn't do as well as you. No, I closed my eyes for a second when you were talking about the story, and I thought, okay, like how would I draw a bicycle? And you were talking about the triangle at that point just a minute ago, and I thought, how does that triangle go on? And it took me about 10 seconds, and then I got it, right? Because I ride bikes, but...
Well, that's the thing is you ride bikes. Like, if you've ever changed a chain, you know the chain, where the chain is.
You know where the chain is.
You know how there's, like, a large place where the axle of the pedals actually go. Like, you kind of understand where that is in comparison to other things.
But it's just, it's interesting.
But if you haven't ridden a bike since you were a kid, totally. Why would you have a really good understanding of the mechanics of it?
It's a mechanical machine that a lot of us interface with and interact with, but not necessarily intimately, right?
Didn't you used to like bring a folded bike in your backpack too?
I did. I know how I could draw that.
I bet you could draw that one.
Well, probably pretty well.
Yeah. Is that why some of these have really tiny wheels on
them?
It's
weird. So it's like all of the little details. Because if you miss a little detail, like, oh, there's a fork, then all of a sudden your bike can't turn. Or if you miss the little detail of like, oh, the chain definitely goes back from the pedal.
No, but when you're drawing this, you have to draw it so that it would work. So you're not drawing your memory, you're drawing the machine that has to work in the way you think it would work. I wouldn't draw it from just what I think it looks like, I'd draw it from how it works.
But if you're drawing something, you'll think, how will this work if I build it? Like, oh no, it can't be this way because
I would do that.
It wouldn't work. But if you're not someone who has built a lot of stuff, right?
Sure.
And you're not someone who has worked on bicycles, then you've got there are all these pieces to a bike, but if you forget one, if you get one slightly wrong, then the way the entire mechanism operates changes dramatically. And it becomes very apparent when you see like a 3D rendering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I look at these renderings and when I look at the actual drawings, there's two things that pop out of me. The first thing that pops out of me is, that just won't work. On some of these, I start looking at them and realize, wait a second, that's really cool. And I could see how you could actually make that work. And somebody's come up with some really cool design.
Awesome.
And it's all because they sketched something out that it was just an idea. And this is how a lot of the design process of anything happens. So I think this is also a good lesson on how people actually are designers if they just sit down and let themselves do it.
We'll have a link to this story and also a picture of, you know, Greg, who is our Canadian mm-hmm. correspondent who does a lot of our writing for us. He makes bikes. And
oh, he does.
Some of his bikes aren't like this. They're really, he just sent a picture and we'll put it up on the Geekspeak website of a bike where the it's kind of a tricycle and you sit in between the two big back wheels. And it looks like it would be very comfortable to sit on this bike. So anyway, we'll put those up. We'll put the story up on Geekspeak. And of course, today's show is the 23rd of April. So how you find it. It's episode 16.
I have a feeling we actually will see some of these built at Burning Man.
I think some of these already, are at Burning Man.
They already build crazy bikes for Burning Man.
Definitely. Well, I hate to jump you right into another story, Brian, but that's just the way the show works sometimes. Can you tell us about trolls? Or first, you know what? Can Ben tell us what a troll is?
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about what
I don't know if I know what a troll is.
Internet trolls.
Internet trolls.
I don't know if I could tell you. I don't really interact with trolls.
Yes, you know how they work.
No,
Ben, you do. Oh, you're trolling me.
I'm being a troll right now. I know what a troll is, and that's me. So I'm deliberately, well, I don't know. Like, how do you define internet troll? It just kind of encompasses a lot of things, but I guess fundamentally there's kind of a misleading element to it, but not necessarily a malicious misleading.
Right. Sometimes it's malicious.
Yeah, sometimes it is.
And it's true. There's not an agreed definition of what a troll is. People have all sorts of definitions. But have you ever been...
I've got a definition, which okay. is from Wikipedia. It says, in internet slang, a troll is a person who sows discord on the internet by starting arguments or upsetting people by posting inflammatory, extraneous, or off-topic messages in an online community, such as a newsgroup, forum, chat, or blog, with the deliberate intent of provoking readers into... into something, often for their own amusement.
So finally, a Wikipedia article that has some truth to it.
Yeah.
So that's right. A troll, right? Because I've implemented a statement that's incorrect mm-hmm. to entice you guys to argue with me. That kind of thing.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, that's good.
I find good stuff on Wikipedia all the time. And by the way, we have this doc in front of us, and you guys were changing the font of this story so that it would annoy as I read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so of all of the stories, this is the only one that has all the really worst fonts in Google Docs. Yeah.
It's perfect.
Impact.
What's the story, Brian?
Okay, so this is a write-up in The Atlantic, and I believe this just came out today. And what it is about is it gets into a number of issues, but I don't know. I've used Twitter kind of heavily now for a year or two, and I've never seen the dark side of Twitter. But mm-hmm. When people get on the internet, they tend to embrace the anonymity, and the worst parts of them seem to come out. And I don't see this, but have you guys been in forums or Twitter or anywhere else where you just see the worst part of people come out?
I've seen people take pictures and retweet things that have happened to them, but I've never been the target of these kinds of things.
I've never been the target, but I have seen people targeted. And actually, YouTube comments are a really awful place.
I don't even pay attention to those.
But yeah, and actually, I don't read YouTube comments anymore. I deliberately avoid them because they tend to be a very bad place with people.
Keep in mind, we're three very highly privileged people in the U.S., right? We're three white men. So, of course, we're not getting attacked as much as other people are.
Well, yeah, but you would see comments attacking other people or something like that. Yeah, but it's possible. The funny thing is, I just don't run into this for some reason.
You don't even see any of it.
Oh, so what I did early on when I was running JavaScript conferences, I hooked up to a lot of developers. I was just trying to find people that would come talk at conferences. And so I started following people that had really cool open source projects and also talked to other conferences. And it is relatively common for women in that role of expert technologist to be attacked. And so the engineers that I follow that get attacked, that repost stuff, and there's kind of a bit of a, we all support each other in the sense that if somebody's attacked, we'll go ahead and block the other person out. So I do participate at that level. And I see that because of that.
Right.
Following people that are... standing up. Mm-hmm.
And there's the people have tried to figure out when this started going on. And it goes back to the earliest days of the internet as well. That
message boards?
So in the New York Times in 1984, there was some note about some surprising prevalence of rudeness, profanity, and all these other emotional outbursts that they're seeing on this new thing called the internet. It seems to have always been there, and it's probably mm-hmm. from anonymity. But there's other social things going on there that are really, really interesting to think about. But there's horrible things, especially women are largely a target mm-hmm. to this. And one of the places this happens regularly that is really difficult is publications that are on the web. And they often are struggling with their forums and their handling the comments on their posts.
Right, to make it stay neutral and not nasty.
Yeah, and nobody has any real research on whether this is increasing, decreasing, or whether it's just the normal noise of the internet. Although there was a major analysis by The Guardian, and they went in and looked at their comment section, and they figured a few interesting things out. Out of the 10 writers who are regularly trolled on their posts they put up, 8 out of 10 of them are women, and the other 2 are black men. So right there, we're getting back into, this is often directed at women. But it can be directed at anybody, depending on what stance you take.
Yeah. So they basically analyzed their own commenting system on their articles.
Right, because they found the data. Nasty.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. And I guess they haven't been deleting. They've probably been marking them as do not republish. Because like one of the things that,
Right. You get to the point where a thread has just gotten so out of hand, you just stop the commenting on that.
And another tactic of a system like this is if the thread is really out of hand, what you can do is that the logged in user that actually had to make the comment, instead of terminating the account or instead of blocking their content from them, you just hide it from everybody else and allow them to keep on making posts. No one else sees the posts and the person's time is wasted and no one responds to them because no one even knows they're there. So it's a very devious way of killing a troll's input. You don't block them because if you block them, they'll make another account. You just silently turn them off so that no one else can see their posts.
Right. And so how do you deal with the trolls? Most of the advice is don't engage with them.
Right. Silence them. But don't let them even know they've been silenced.
Right,
that's
right.
Because
then they'll attack. Then they'll find another way to attack.
Sure.
But one of the ways most people probably would not recommend is to actually engage with them. And this article starts to explore that a little bit on whether that's the right way to deal with trolls. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about the doxing from the Gamergate before.
What is doxing?
Okay. Well,
distributed denial of service attack. Is that right? No,
no.
Dox. What is doxing?
No,
I thought doxing was DDoSing.
No, it's not. No. So,
DDoSing.
It's where trolling goes next. It's when you find documents about a person and you publish them on the internet in an effort to
dox, a verb informal, search for and publish private or identifying information about a particular individual on the internet, typically with malicious intent.
Yeah.
I just learned something. That's awful.
It's really
creepy. It's horrible stuff. So it's where trolling goes when it gets malicious beyond just trolling somebody on the internet.
Right.
So anyways, we talked about Brianna Wu was one of the central figures to Gamergate at the time.
And she actually had to move houses because of this kind of doxing of her information.
And she would even get death threats and other kinds of harassment online. And the interesting thing is whenever she would call out to the police for help with this, they would come to her house and they say, well, you just need to get off social media. But she can't do that. Her entire life is on social
media.
Career, how she markets her products, her games, and everything is on social media. So that wasn't a solution. So
such a bad suggestion. Oh my god!
Exactly. It's where our society hasn't caught up with the realities of modern internet. Anyways, so she had an example of actually engaging with some of the trolls, and it turns out that not everybody that's trolling is truly evil. Understanding what they're doing.
Sure. Yeah, that's the thing is, of course, it's coming from ignorance, right?
Right.
Sexism almost always comes from ignorance, right? I mean, there's this... So she actually had some success in kind of teaching some people what they were doing and how they were affecting?
Exactly. By engaging with the troll and saying, plainly, what are you doing? This is hurtful to me.
She's amazing.
Yeah, no. And I really recommend reading the article to get into... some of the examples more deeply, but a lot of time people are letting their worst self out and they're not even thinking about how much they're being hurtful online.
All right.
So be thoughtful yourself out there.
Should we, thank you for the recommendation. It's The Atlantic and Should We Feed the Trolls? An article by Adrian LaFrance or LaFrance. I don't know. Thanks, Brian. Ben, hey.
Hey. So, as you know, I do a lot of video stuff. And so one of the apps that I have installed is QuickTime.
Great application.
Great. Well, It was a great application. And then they, and I'm talking about OS X QuickTime.
So OS X on my computer, I use all the time. I mean, QuickTime, I use all the time on my computer for doing screen captures because it's built in.
So yeah, yeah. And that it's great for that. It's great for that. There's also QuickTime Pro 7, which was years and years ago. They stopped working on that.
Yes.
And that was much, much better in a lot of ways. It didn't do screen recording and all that stuff, but you could use the JKL keys to scrub through a video. You could change the playback speed. You could do all kinds of things.
It was like a mini video editor. You just didn't know it necessarily unless you really dove into it. And for years, I kept that old version of QuickTime and I'd move it to my different machines with me. I don't have it anymore.
Right. You actually can install it still.
Oh,
I just discovered this, but you still have to pay for the Pro. Anyway, there's also QuickTime. You do? You don't?
No. I believe that's free now. That got released free for a while.
Are you sure?
I'm not sure. I got to look it up.
I was looking around. Anyway, if you can get it for me for free, I would be very happy. QuickTime for Windows also exists as Apple has a lot of their software for Windows as well, like iTunes and whatnot. QuickTime for Windows, well, apparently it's no longer supported. And word of this does not come directly from Apple. It actually comes from another company who is saying that Apple told them this, and Apple is not commenting yet on this. This other company,
why would Apple make QuickTime for Windows?
I mean, why would Apple make iTunes for Windows?
Well, they made iTunes for Windows so they could sell more songs. I mean, it's a really good market, and people are buying podcasts.
Well, actually, this is
iPads.
Oh, sorry for interrupting. This is important because, you know, on the Mac, so much of the media of the entire computer runs on top of the QuickTime
engine
at the core of it. And so iTunes was using that. So when they put iTunes on Windows, they would have needed to move that core over as well.
That may be the case.
It also may be that QuickTime was the first codec that could play some of the video formats they wanted to use for their services. And so they need to get that onto the platform anyway.
Well, no, because there were players for that. I don't want to go into the crazy deep world of video codecs.
But they stopped supporting it.
They stopped supporting it, apparently. And here's how we know about this. A company called Trend Micro, it's a fairly reputable. They just let the world know about two zero-day exploits, critical vulnerabilities that affect QuickTime for Windows, security vulnerabilities. And so, of course, what do we do when this happens? We wait for Apple to make a fix, and then everyone installs it as quickly as possible. Well, they let Apple know about this, and Apple said, yeah, we're not going to fix that. And also QuickTime for Windows is deprecated.
Haven't made a press announcement of that at all. It's kind of a big deal.
It's kind of a big deal. Well, I don't know. I don't know what the usage is.
It's always VLC, right? Like, if you need it.
VLC is another application which will run on the Windows or on the Mac, and it's a great video player.
VideoLAN client.
Yeah. VideoLAN client. There's also MPlayer, I think. There are a bunch of them.
So Apple's notorious for not actually publishing information about security vulnerabilities and even telling people that they're going to stop supporting stuff. This is not unusual. The thing to know about this is that QuickTime for Windows hasn't been supported for QuickTime for Windows 10 and Windows 8. So you have to be using Windows 7 to even be running QuickTime, unless you did some sort of hack to get around that, which is possible.
The thing that bothers me about it, though, is pretty much any other company in almost any other situation, if you look back, will say, hey, by the way, everyone, we're not supporting this anymore.
Right.
This product is dead. We're moving on. Yeah, it's polite. It means that people can move on to other things. They have their time to migrate away from that tool and find another tool. Yeah, not so good. So basically, if you're using QuickTime for Windows on any of your machines today, you should stop immediately and uninstall it immediately because
there's a vulnerability.
There are two critical vulnerabilities, and we don't necessarily know what they are, but they could be exploited, and that could be bad for you. So,
and speaking of things being deprecated, we're going to talk about Nest in a little bit, and then a little bit of iOS stuff, and maybe some Canadian police stories. Stick with us, won't you? Here on KOSP for Geek Speak, we'll be right back. It's GeekSpeak on 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxel. I'm speaking with Ben Jaffe and Mr. Brian Young. Brian, to tell us about Nest, the thermostat by Google.
Okay. No, we're not talking about the thermostat, but we are talking about the company Nest.
Okay.
So Nest is one of the many Alphabet companies.
Is it in?
What do you mean in?
Is it Alphabet companies all named after a letter? Is Nest in?
What's Alphabet company?
Are they?
Alphabet is the new Google. Google rebranded its name. It's called Alphabet. The G in Alphabet is for the Google Corporation. And there's all these different company names, and they go by letters. That? Yeah. You guys didn't know this?
They're doing
this up? I think I made this up. Let me see if I'm right.
No, no, no. The letters represent Android, and that's like candy, right?
No. The Alphabet company is made up of, you know, alphabet of companies.
So they can only have 26 companies?
I think so.
Do they have to like shut one down in order to have a new I if they already had an
I? I don't know. But so, why don't you tell us all about Nest?
This might be lies. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see if I made this all up.
So Nest is one of the Alphabet companies, and they purchased a company called Revolve. Revolve had a product that was one of these many Internet of Thing hubs. So Revolve's hub was used for connecting various devices from Internet of Things sensors that could turn on your light bulbs or open your garage door or one of the many other devices.
Like
that
home automation.
Yeah, home automation.
Yeah.
So they purchased this 17 months ago, and they've decided that they're not going to support the services anymore. Now, for many times when we talk about a story like this, the service that runs the Revolve device might be shut down, but people tend to make use out of a device anyways, even though the original service it ran with is not working anymore. But in this case, when Google shuts down the Revolve device, the device itself will not work. They're basically bricking the device.
Oh, because the device is based off of service, some web service of some kind.
Right. It's exclusively dependent on that service.
So they
don't, like, there's no, you can move over to this alternative or this other company does something similar or anything.
Yes, you could purchase another device from another company.
Oh.
But
no. So you pay money for this hardware device, and after a period of time, they decide to stop doing the service, and the hardware device is just dead.
Yeah, a period of less than, I believe, 2 years. What's really notable about that is that when people purchased the device, it had a lifetime guarantee.
No.
No, it still works, just doesn't work.
Oh.
Okay, the whole Alphabet, the tagline of Larry Page's email, first post about Alphabet being the new Google is Alphabet, G is for Google. So that little phrasing to me meant that all the companies were going to have letters, because that sounds like a geeky thing
to do.
You're
so logical.
Right, but that's not the case. Here are some companies. Calico, that could be C. Fiber is one of them. Google, Google Capital, Google Ventures. Google, and underneath Google is Android Search, YouTube, Apps, Maps, Ads, Nest, Verily. So it doesn't really correlate with letters.
Two-letter combinations.
It's not. It's unfortunately, they didn't do the geeky, nerdy thing that I thought would happen, because I think of sci-fi more interesting than the world.
So they don't have a letter for Google Car, right? Because this is important. What if you purchased a Google car?
And they turn off the service?
Yes. They decide, you know what, we're not going to support this car any longer.
It's really a shame. You know, they did that to a product that was used quite a bit. What was the reader, the news reader of Google's?
Google Reader.
Google Reader.
Yeah. Yeah, they're known for being ruthless with their software, especially in the previous few years where they decided that they really needed to clean up their act and shut down projects that just weren't meeting their expectations.
Right. But Google Reader, no one ever paid for. And no one ever had any hardware. I mean, basically what's happening is with this hub thing, what is it called?
Revolve.
The Revolve piece of hardware, you just have to throw it away now because they're turning off a web service.
Right.
Well, ideally you would e-cycle it.
The point to you is touche.
Yeah, we were talking about pedantics earlier before the show.
You always talk about pedantics.
I do have to say, when Google Reader went away, GeekSpeak got a lot harder for me.
Well,
because
like
that's what I would use it, and I would catalog all of the news and what news I would cover and in what way on Google Reader. And then it went away. And it took months before a half-decent alternative, which I currently use Dig Reader, but it's...
Not as good.
It's not as good now.
No. Sure, it left a huge vacuum in the space. I mean, it's amazing how a free product can actually... influence so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
First world problems.
But in case, that's information, though.
It's interesting. I mean, you actually have a story. So basically, by choice, the Nest company under the Alphabet, which used to be formerly called Google, has decided to destroy the use of all these different products. I am hoping that some ingenious hacker comes out a way to play Flappy Birds on this thing. Well, not Flappy Birds,
exactly.
But can recreate infrastructure for it. That would be really great.
Yeah, yeah. On one hand, you hope it has the security that you could run your entire house on it. On the other hand, you hope there's vulnerabilities in there that some hacker could let you keep using it in some way. Do you really want to run your entire house on a device that you've hacked in order to get it to keep working?
Ben, what do you think? Do you think you'd want to have like a thermostat or something that someone could remotely turn your house on and off?
Funny you would say that.
Ben made one of these.
I did. I set up a little Raspberry Pi. Actually, it wasn't a Raspberry Pi. It was a really cheap little chip that could connect up to Firebase, actually.
Yeah.
And
Firebase is pretty cool, though.
Firebase is really cool. They make security so easy. And yet, the longest time, I didn't have any security on
Ben
my
showed
heater.
Me a webpage once, and he had a picture of his fireplace on this webpage. And you could click on it. And he's like, cool, the fire's on, right? I'm like, yeah. He's like, yeah, my heater's now on in my house. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, there's no security on this at all. But it's cool.
What could go wrong?
Well, worst case is your house gets hot or cold when you don't want it to.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
It's not like all your doors get unlocked like this next thing.
Oh, no.
All right, so what's you've got another story about hardware being
bricking. Oh, yeah,
actually,
speaking of bricking, now this is a... Do you remember a while back, it was only like a month ago, we covered a story that if you set your iPhone's date to January 1st, 1970... That then the
you could never get it back. Yeah, it just killed it. Don't do this.
Wait, don't do it.
Okay. You could get it back. You had to wait until the battery was completely dead.
Well, that's the addendum to the story, right?
That.
Is that maybe.
Maybe. It was not a sure thing.
They've been getting this story at softpedia.com they've been getting some reports that letting the battery dream could make the iPhone work again. But don't try it.
Unless you want to break your phone.
Right. Yeah. Which really, if you want to break your phone, just throw it away.
Is it? Do you have to enter a password to change someone's time?
I don't know. I don't have an iPhone. Do you want to try it?
Well, there's a lot. No. Yeah, this iPhone 6 Plus. So normally, on a lot of features on the phone, like connecting to services or disconnecting or adding things, I mean, there's a lot of times where you get prompted for the password or your thumbprint. Sometimes even the password and the thumbprint, like you've got to actually put in your password again.
Right.
If the time is not example of that, if you could change the time without putting a password in, which I bet you could, if you give your phone to anybody and you give them access to it, they could kill your phone.
They could. They could also do so by throwing it out the window. I mean,
that's a really good point. Yeah. If you give them possession of it. You know,
actually, have you ever tried to change the time? You've got to scroll through years and years of like super fast scrolling just to get to
it. Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
It's just really... because you have to go all the way to the bottom.
Right. It's not a digital apps. Type in a number. It is one of the iOS scrolling number fields.
I hate that. The multi-select in iOS is one of the worst features, I think. Anyway,
multi-select.
Well, drop down select item, and in HTML, the select field.
Oh, you mean where and it slides up a thing from the bottom? Where
no. When you do a select field on a web form in iOS, it gives you that wheel of all the values.
Yes.
You can't type. It doesn't give you.
Sorry.
Are you being bored?
I just yawned. I don't have an iPhone, so this doesn't mean anything to me. But that actually was a real yawn. It was contrived, though. It turns out this story is back. Because there is another way to change a phone's time, and you don't need physical access to the device.
Oh, no. How?
You know what it is?
No.
It's...
Wait. Do you put it into under high gravity effect or high acceleration?
Well, wait. There's two ways that a phone changes its time. There's manually, but usually it connects up to a time server.
It does. Time servers.
Yes, it does. Yes, indeed, it does.
NTP,
yeah. Hey, acronym soup. You got it right. A rogue NTP server. So
network time protocol.
If I wanted to mess up everyone's iPhone, I could just run a device, a malicious NTP server, which is just basically a computer that's running on a Wi-Fi network, and then all of the iPhones, if they choose to connect up to that thing, they'll be like, oh, hey, a time server.
So
hey, time server, what time is it?
You'd also have to respond to the DNS query because the DNS, most of the phones are actually set up with DNS to figure out which NTP server. You can change which one it is. But DNS is notoriously bad at security. And so you could inject a DNS response for the NTP server with a different IP address. And if it wasn't checking a cert, which it probably isn't because NTP doesn't, I don't think, support certs, you could do that. Has someone done that? Because that's bad.
Well, I'm sure someone has messed with NTP servers.
No, but if you could do that, you could brick a whole bunch of phones.
Yeah. So these researchers discovered they could do exactly that.
Oh, that's not good at all.
So yeah. So basically, your device says, "Oh, hey, a server. What time is it?" And the server says, "Oh, it's January." So like, your phone is not like you or me. If I had told you, "Hey, Lyle, by the way, it's 1970 right now."
I'm not alive yet.
Well, you're very gullible, right?
I just passed out of coma for 4 years.
But if you think about it, like, phones don't have any way of knowing what time it is or isn't. They don't have an internal clock necessarily.
Ben, they do have an internal clock.
Like we do, I'm saying.
They have no consciousness of their internal
clock. Their battery could die. And then they could... So, like, if our battery dies effectively, then we're dead. We can't be resuscitated. What I'm saying is, because we're long-running devices, us humans, we don't really forget the time and then think we're 40 years or 50 years, you know, in the
younger,
past. Normally. So, anyway. Oh,
that's awesome. Sorry.
Yeah.
And kind of sad.
That's an awesome story.
I hope
story.
No one like gets affected by it in mass, because you could... theoretically
so this it, has been patched t- this oh, this good. Has been patched, and this is the only reason I'm talking about it.
Good, right? Thanks. You stressed me out, man.
But yeah, basically what happened is then the iPhone thinks it's that time. Actually, you would set the clock to December 31st, 1969, 23:59, so like 1 minute before 1970, and then the device would just sit there and get really, really, really hot
as it tries to figure out what time it really is.
And then it would shut down because it got too hot. So I guess you could prolong its life by putting in the freezer. None of this is a good idea. Don't do anything I
Moving
just talked
on.
About.
Thank you very much, Ben.
You're welcome.
All right, let's talk about Canada.
Okay, let's talk about Canada. So BlackBerry is known for having a really secure device because
the president uses a BlackBerry.
Yeah, our president.
Our president.
Our
does.
President, not the Canadian president,
maybe
because they don't have a Canadian president.
The prime minister might. I don't know.
So BlackBerry is known for having a secure messaging platform. And the reason why it's secure is it's encrypted. And anybody who uses a BlackBerry device that uses the default BlackBerry messaging service, now this is not one that is internal company BlackBerry service, but the regular service you would get if you just got a BlackBerry, because I'll get into that in a minute. Anyways, it's all encrypted, and there is one single master key.
Oh, no, that's not a good thing.
That's a really bad beginning to a story.
It's a really bad beginning, because all you have to do is get that master key, and what do you have? You got the...
You can unlock any of the data that goes through BlackBerry.
Anything that goes through. So they obviously have been holding on this key really, really securely, really well.
Right.
And
this is important.
Yeah, it's important.
But aren't keys like that always like backwards detectable because they're in the devices? I mean,
I don't know if this is in the device, but I know the communication that goes across the wire, it could be encrypted with it. So I don't know if the device has the key.
If the device needs to unencrypt it, it has the key.
Well, no, there's public private key.
If it's public private key, it's not a single key. So if a device is unencrypting something that only there's only one private key and it's unencrypting it, you've got this problem where the key is probably in the device, just like the DVD paradigm. But at the same time, if it's in the BlackBerry chip, it's hard to get to, and they did it right, it would be extremely difficult to find out what that key is.
Mm-hmm. Unless a government came knocking at your door and demanded to have it, and you
said yes.
It on.
Oh, and that happened?
So we don't know how the Canadian government got the key, but it did leak out this week through government, through a court action that the Canadian government has had the key for at least 5 years.
Of BlackBerry's.
Of BlackBerry's
five
messaging
years?
Platform. Yes. So now this does not mean that President Obama's BlackBerry can have its messages read. In fact, you can set up a BlackBerry server, an enterprise server, if you're a company yourself. Those keys are not what we're talking about. We're talking about the default messaging platform that BlackBerry sells.
And in fact, when you do messaging through a company, like the White House probably does this, the key exchange, everything goes only to your servers. That's the whole idea, that it's really friendly to an enterprise environment. Unlike Apple devices, where a messenger goes to Apple, you can set it up so the messaging, if you will, equivalent, goes to the corporation. Hence the reason why it's been so successful in corporations and security has been touted, because of that idea that the IT administration group is responsible for that. So, but the one that everyone uses by default, especially if you're a private individual, Canadian government could be listening in the entire time.
Yes, they've got the key. And if one government has the key, Ben, your point before when we were talking about this is that any government could potentially have the key because there right. is some amount of sharing between our right. different governments. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was about 5 years ago that India was really, was it India or Pakistan was making a big stink with BlackBerry to get the access to the private
same
messaging.
Data. Yeah. Who knows what governments actually have it, you know?
But this is the whole thing about keeping communications private. Why is it important? Why did the Apple stand up to the FBI and try to say that they weren't going to allow a way to change their software so that it would make it easier for the FBI to get and crack that encryption? This stuff's hard. All these exploits that we're talking about are being found all the time, and it's really hard to keep these things secure.
All right. Well, thanks. Kind of sad. Sorry about that news. I think it's a good idea to understand that something like the BlackBerry, over time, it's just going to deprecate its usefulness, right? Government's going to have keys to it, but in general, it's going to become more less and less secure over time. In just a minute, Ben's going to tell us all about hacking with the...
Another berry.
Okay. Not a BlackBerry, but mm-mm. something else. But first, I want to let you know that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use their stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the geeks say hi. This is independent public radio, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. To find out about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit GeekSpeak.org. Thanks so much to our intern, Chandler, and to our support geek, Greg Merkel, who, by the way, says he did not actually make that bike.
Oh, he didn't?
No, that's what he said. He said he didn't. Mm. So very confusing. Bike is showed, not one I built. So he does have pictures of bikes he has built, though, so we'll see that up at GeekSpeak.org. Also, Michael Newman, thank you, of Pet Star Music, thank you for our theme song. And thanks, everyone, for listening to episode 16 of our 16th season. And Brian, thank you so much for being here.
And yeah, it was great.
Ben, thank you. And do tell us.
16.
What berry are you hacking about?
Raspberry. Well, Raspberry Pi, at least. Mm-hmm. I've been really interested in Amazon's Alexa
Echo.
And Echo and all that stuff, partially because it seems kind of cool to have a little thing in your house that you can talk.
Of course, totally want one.
Security,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
But also...
Privacy.
Cool.
Yeah.
But also, Amazon released up on GitHub a guide, a project of using their Alexa voice service using a Java client running on a Raspberry Pi and a Node.js server.
They have been very friendly to the hackerspace mm-hmm. about Alexa and Echo. Like,
right.
you can really do some cool stuff with it.
Alexa is the thing that sits in your house, and you can say, hey, Alexa, you know, play music on Spotify or whatever
so
it is.
So Echo is the thing in the house.
Oh,
Alexa
the Echo
is the AI on it.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Yeah.
This is, I think, a really good way to foster a community.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, make a bunch of free stuff, put it out there and say, like, people, build this stuff. It's free.
Hey,
like,
hey Apple, Ben's talking to you. Come on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Cool. So who's going to buy one first? That's what I want to know.
I've been thinking about it.
Yeah, me too. Hey, thanks for being here. See you guys next week.
Thanks so much.